You're listening to KPFA 94.1 in Berkeley, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, and 88.1 KFCF in Fresno.
Good morning. It's Friday, July 15th, 2016. This is Upfront. On today's show, this Sunday marks the 72nd anniversary of the Port Chicago disaster, in which 320 men lost their lives. We'll speak with Robert Allen. Plus, we'll explore the impact of the growth of white supremacist organizations and ideology in Northern California. That's all next, after the news.
I'm Eileen Alfandary with KPFA News Headlines. France is in mourning after a truck rammed into a crowd celebrating Bastille Day in the seaside town of Nice. 84 are dead. Two U.S. citizens are among the dead. And hospitalized 28 children. French President François Hollande extended the country's state of emergency by another 3 months.
La France a été frappée le jour de sa fête nationale.
On July 14th, France was stricken on its national day, a symbol of freedom, because fanatics deny the human rights, and France is their obvious target. On behalf of our bemoaning nation, I address my solidarity towards the victims and their families.
À l'égard des victimes et de leurs familles.
Hollande said it wasn't clear whether the assailant had accomplices. There's been no claim of responsibility. French police shot the truck driver dead at the scene. Authorities say he was a 31-year-old French Tunisian man. They say he'd been involved in petty crimes but was not known to intelligence authorities. This is the third mass attack in France in the last 18 months. Al Jazeera spoke to a witness.
There were people on the ground, yes, people on the ground, many, many. I was trying not to look. I didn't want to see. I tried to look at the sky. It was too painful, too painful.
A journalist for the regional newspaper Nice Matin, who was at the waterside, said the fireworks display had finished and the crowd was leaving when they heard a noise and cries. He wrote in his online account, "A fraction of a second later, an enormous white truck came along at a crazy speed, turning the wheel to mow down the maximum number of people." The journalist wrote, "I saw bodies flying like bowling pins along its route, heard noises, cries that I will never forget." France has been under a high-risk surveillance system since the last terror attacks in Paris last November, which killed 130 people and injured 400. Over the past few months, the so-called state of emergency had sparked controversy, opponents saying France was becoming an increasingly authoritarian state. Before last night's attack in Nice, Hollande was set to meet officials to discuss the end of the controversial state of emergency planned for the 26th of the month. But the French president announced that the so-called Sentinel operation, which puts 10,000 soldiers in the streets, will be extended. We'll have more on the story immediately following the newscast with reporter Nina Pareja in France. Donald Trump's campaign chairman says the Republican presidential candidate has settled on a running mate. Paul Manafort told Fox News he thinks Trump has reached a decision but isn't prepared to announce it yet. Trump had planned to introduce his pick at a news conference this morning in New York, but tweeted he would postpone the event because of the deadly attack in France. This after a day of rampant speculation that Indiana Governor Mike Pence had emerged as a late favorite for the job. Mourners gather today to pay their last respects to Alton Sterling, fatally shot by police officers in Baton Rouge last week outside a convenience store. Sterling leaves behind five children. Yesterday, Philando Castile was laid to rest. He was fatally shot by a police officer last week in suburban St. Paul. California State School Board unanimously has approved curriculum guidelines that include LGBT history and contributions to the state and the nation. The changes are designed to satisfy legislation passed by California lawmakers 5 years ago. Christopher Martinez reports.
With that unanimous vote by the State Board of Education, the history of gay rights now becomes part of history education in California schools. The action fulfills the promise of a first-in-the-nation law requiring public schools to include prominent gay people and milestones in LGBT history in school history and social science curricula. That means students will learn about historic milestones like Stonewall and prominent LGBT figures like Harvey Milk. The action was hailed by civil rights groups like the ACLU and LGBT activists that have pushed for a more inclusive curriculum that recognizes LGBT history. Rick Oculto is with Our Families Coalition, a group that supports equity for LGBTQ families with children.
By including fair, accurate, and inclusive representations of LGBT people in our history and social sciences, we hold true to the promise that every student and every family is included in the fabric that we weave together as our nation. Let us support our teachers in creating a climate where the plurality of our nation is celebrated.
The new guidelines will introduce discussions of diverse families in the second grade, as well as lessons on California's role in gay rights in the fourth grade. School curricula will also include topics like gender roles and, in high school classes, the 2015 Supreme Court ruling that recognized marriages of same-sex couples. The final curriculum guidelines are only one step in deciding what's taught in schools. It's up to local school districts and charter schools to develop their own curricula. The guidelines also set the stage for what will be included in school textbooks, a separate process that will be coming up in future months. Reporting from the state capitol, I'm Christopher Martinez.
The faculty union at City College of San Francisco has come to a tentative contract agreement with City College District Administration. Following more than a year of tense negotiations, mediation, and a one-day strike, the union, the American Federation of Teachers Local 2121, is moving forward to ratify a new three-year contract that will include a salary increase for members after nearly a decade of stagnating wages. Faculty at City College held a first-ever one-day strike in April, charging unfair labor practices. Before this week's agreement, another strike was set for the fall. The administration had maintained that the San Francisco Community College District had insufficient resources to fund a salary increase. San Francisco City College has lost hundreds of faculty due to cuts and a crisis of enrollment following the school almost losing its accreditation. The new contract is set to end in June of 2018. California Governor Jerry Brown has hired former Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt to help try to make Brown's proposal for two giant water tunnels a reality. Officials confirm that former Clinton-era Interior Secretary Babbitt has signed on as a senior advisor to the $15.7 billion tunnels project at $10,000 a month. Weather forecast for the San Francisco Bay Area. Patchy fog, partly cloudy skies this morning, then sunny and breezy. Highs in the 70s to lower 80s around the bay, lower to mid-90s well inland. In Fresno and the central San Joaquin Valley, sunny. Highs 98 to 104 degrees. I'm Eileen Alfandari. More news on 94.1 at 7:30.
Good morning. You are listening to Upfront. I am Kat Brooks filling in for Brian Edwards-Tiekert. This is French President François Hollande.
France is tearful, afflicted, but France is strong and will always remain stronger than the fanatics who want to harm her.
Hollande has arrived in the seaside town of Nice following last night's attack by a man who drove a truck at high speed through a crowd of people celebrating Bastille Day, which is a national holiday. We're joined on the line by Nina Pareja, a former KPFA reporter who now works with French Radio France in Tier. Good morning, Nina. Well, good morning for us.
Good morning, Ted. Good morning.
Nina, describe for us what happened yesterday.
Well, around 11 p.m., a large, big truck drove into La Promenade des Anglais, which is like the most famous place in Nice, where more than 30,000 people were gathered to watch the firework organized each year to celebrate the Bastille Day. And the truck driver drove like crazy for like 0.6 miles. The truck ran over people, knocking people on the ground. The police tried a first time to stop him, but he fired a gun at them, and then they managed to kill him, firing like 50 bullets at the truck. And so for now, we know for sure that 84 people were killed, 18 others are into a life-threatening condition, and like dozens of others are injured, and more are in a state of shock, of course.
Of course. The assailant has been identified as a 31-year-old Tucsonian man with French residency. Have authorities released any other information about him?
Well, no, we know his name, which is Mohamed Laouehi Bouhel, and that he had been arrested several times for acts of violence, but we don't have a lot of information on him, and the police doesn't really want to release anything else for now.
Did they say what other types of acts of violence he'd been previously arrested for?
Well, apparently, not so long ago, he had been arrested for violence due to a car accident or something. And some press news released that he was a violent and sad man, but we don't know for sure. We don't have, like, official sources that are saying that that man was violent, so mm-hmm. we'd rather say nothing for now, mm-hmm. I would say.
Mm-hmm. And no organized group has claimed responsibility for the attack, is that correct?
Yeah, not yet. But the President Hollande and all the politics, they claim it's a terrorist attack, of course, due to the violence employed, even though we don't know for sure that it's ISIL or whatever other organization.
Right. This is the third such mass attack in 18 months. What is the mood in France today?
Well, it's a lot for everyone. First, there were the Charlie attack in January 2015, and then November 2015. And on top of that, our neighbors were touched, like Belgium, which is really close from France and where there is a lot of French residents, mm-hmm. and which is the center of Europe. And then a few months ago, a smaller attack. A lonely man killed two police officers a couple of months ago, and he claimed that it was a terrorist attack. And then Istanbul and so many other countries, I mean, people are really tired about it and in a state of shock. On social media, you can see that people want to know where and when they're going to stop. I mean, just yesterday, the president, he said he congrats the security that we put in place for their soccer tournament, the Euro, and that no attacks happened, and he was really glad about it, and now just the night after that, another one. But the good thing is that people always show solidarity. I mean, they use, again, the hashtag open doors yesterday to welcome people that were lost in Nice or who didn't have a place to go. Mm-hmm. But the major reaction is anger, and people are tougher and tougher in the way they describe their anger throughout the attacker, of course.
Right. Well, I mean, this is sort of being in a consistent state of trauma and being re-triggered. So.
Yes.
Right. So you mentioned Hollande being happy that he felt like he could, you know, lax the state of emergency. But now, of course, the country's state of emergency has been extended for another 3 months. What does that entail, and what have the impacts been so far?
Well, the impact visually for the people living in France is military and police presence everywhere, in front of big building, embassy, well, all the important place. Some protests have been canceled, or I mean, the government tried to cancel protests, or also just to have a shorter walk because they were afraid that they could not contain such a big walk. But basically, the state of emergency allowed the executive to have more forces. I mean, there is like 10,000 military mobilized right now, and the president would like to see even more forces mobilized using reservists that would work like 1 month a year or maybe more. And they also can organize police search raids without search warrants. So there is like since the Paris attack, I think they searched 3,500 places without search warrant, just to be sure they're...
Are those searches impacting a specific demographic of people? Is it equal opportunity searching, or are certain groups of folks being targeted?
Well, they search the place where they have intelligence and when they know they could be a threat because they left to the Middle East for some reason. So, I mean, of course, it's targeted the people that are from Middle East more because they tend to go more often. And there were some bad targeting, because there is a big social movement happening right now, sometimes they use it to target the place where activists were. But it's basically just searches to investigate and try to find the attacker before their attack, so it's not that bad.
Nina, and what about French politics? Does this latest attack give a boost to the right, do you think?
Well, we can't really tell for now, but yes, of course. I mean, our left-wing president and its government are so not popular right now, and the right-wing could use it really easily for the next election in 2017. There is already some right-wing politics that demand a permanent state of emergency that would last forever. One of the right-wing candidates say the lack of means in terms of security is in part responsible for the attack of last night, and that with more security, the attack could have been prevented. Mm-hmm. Which is a strong thing, but the thing is, Nice is one of the best cities in terms of security in France, especially because it's a big touristic area. Mm-hmm. So the security was huge. So we don't really know if more security could have prevented the attack. And the right wing, they think we should put more means in terms of intelligence agency and search, and basically that's what they want. So yeah, the right wing politics speeches are to say that France is at war and that we need to counterattack more aggressively too, that we need to go back to Middle East, Syria, Iraq, and send forces and strikes, and it's not really good.
Sounds like our presidential candidates out here, too. Nina, thank you so much for joining us. Our thoughts and our prayers are with you and the French people. Take care.
Thanks so much. Bye.
Bye-bye. This weekend is the 72nd anniversary of the Port Chicago disaster. We're joined by scholar Robert Allen right after this music break. You are listening to Upfront. I am Kat Brooks, filling in for Brian Edwards Tiekert. This Sunday, the National Park Service will hold a ceremony commemorating the worst home front disaster of World War II. Just 15 miles east of Vallejo, a segregated black unit was loading live ammunition onto ships bound for the Pacific when 5,000 tons of munitions exploded, killing 320 men, 200 of which were black. When the survivors refused to continue loading explosives, they were charged with mutiny. Family members and legislators are now urging President Obama to exonerate these sailors. Catherine Monahan has the story.
72 years ago, a 3-mile-wide fireball obliterated Port Chicago, killing more than 300 people, over 200 of them black, and injuring hundreds more. Reverend Diana McDaniel, whose uncle survived the explosion, thinks the story is just as important today.
For me, it's the ultimate Black Lives Matter story. These were young men. Some of them were underage who joined the military, who wanted to serve their country. They really wanted to go off to the Pacific Theater and fight, but they were put in a place to do the loading of the munitions. And it was one of those situations where they could not even go to the bathroom on ships that they were, where they were loading. They might have to walk half a mile to go to the bathroom.
All the sailors were black and all the officers were white. The sailors were given no training in handling explosives and were told, falsely, that the explosives were not armed. Here are some of the original sailors, as interviewed by Dan Collison of Long Haul Productions.
Here come them big bombs and things coming down the rampway they had built. But sometime they let it come down too fast. And they hit together and they made a loud noise. And that would almost give you a heart attack. Yeah, you would almost have a heart attack. And so we used to ask them sometime and say, is it any danger this ammunition explode? They say, oh, no, don't worry about it. Say, it's not live. Say, it don't have no detonators in them.
To add to the danger, the white officers were betting on whose division could load the fastest.
The division commanders push the petty officers to push the men to load as much as they could, as fast as they could. But we knew they were betting $100 or so that my division would put on more ammunition than your division.
Crews loaded 24 hours a day, and on the night of July 17th, 1944, two ships full of fuel and ammunition exploded in a blast felt as far away as Nevada. An airplane pilot flying 9,000 feet in the air said chunks of metal flew by him.
The sky lit up. And it's just like the sun rose. Everything is bright. You can see all the buildings. For a second, then came the concussion. The concussion blew in the wind all over my body. My left arm got mutilated. Face, head, neck, shoulders, and body.
Sailors went out into the night to try to help each other and dug through a rubble of body parts and twisted rail cars. White officers were then granted 30 days leave to recover from trauma and injuries, but black sailors were ordered to continue loading ammunition at Mare Island in Vallejo, and those who said they wouldn't, not without training and safety regulations, were charged with mutiny and imprisoned. At the end of the war, they were released and given dishonorable discharges. By now, all those involved in the disaster are dead. But California lawmakers, including Bay Area Congress members Barbara Lee and Mark DeSaulnier, are asking President Obama to exonerate the sailors before he leaves office. Diana McDaniel is part of this effort, believing that men like her uncle should be commended.
They did their best to win the war. They put their hearts into it, their effort into it, and if they had had the opportunity, they would have gone off to fight in a different way. But here they were fighting on two fronts. You know, they were fighting racism in the United States, and they were trying to fight a war to win World War II.
Scholar Robert Allen says that, in fact, these men did win a victory, though they didn't know it at the time.
Their action, far from condemning them, actually condemned the Navy and its practices and led to some important changes then, not only in the Navy, but in the U.S. military as a whole. When in 1948, President Truman issued an order desegregating the military entirely.
Richard Soublé, whose father was injured in the explosion, hopes people will come to the National Park Service Memorial this Sunday at 3:30 p.m. at the former Concord Naval Weapons Station, the site of the Port Chicago disaster.
I'm glad that every year on this date, we remember what took place at Port Chicago, and I think that we should always remember what took place at Port Chicago. It is the largest disaster that happened on human soil affecting American sailors and soldiers in their lives, and I think we need to continue to remember them, and we need to continue to honor them.
For KPFA and Pacifica Radio, I'm Catherine Monahan.
It is 7:24 in the morning. This is Upfront. I am Kat Brooks, filling in for Brian Edwards-Tiekert. Sunday is the 72nd anniversary of the Port Chicago disaster. On the phone with us this morning is scholar, activist, and author Robert Allen. Mr. Allen wrote the book, The Port Chicago Mutiny, the story of the largest mass mutiny trial in U.S. naval history. Good morning, Robert. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning. Good morning.
Robert, what led you to this topic? Why were you compelled to tell this story?
Well, I had never heard of the story myself. I was a journalist. This is back in the 1970s. And I happened to come across a leaflet that had been published by the NAACP in 1945 about this case. And I read it, and I was astonished. As I said, I'd never heard of this, and I was immediately fascinated by the idea that these men had, in fact, been convicted of mutiny, which seemed outrageous given the circumstances, and had been given long prison terms. So it was out of this discovery of the pamphlet, which was published by the NAACP to publicize the case, that I was brought into doing this research. And I've been working on that for the past 40-some-odd years now.
Wow.
And I believe, we hope, we're finally getting close to the point where we can get these sailors exonerated. They did not commit mutiny, and in fact, their work stoppage, which is what it was, led to the process of desegregation of the U.S. Navy and ultimately the U.S. military. So the outcome in terms of its impact on U.S. society and, in fact, on the military was positive, and the sailors themselves did not commit mutiny. We believe they should be exonerated.
As we heard in the story, the munitions handlers were ultimately blamed for the explosion, but there was a series of circumstances that led up to this explosion. Can you talk about that in terms of what the protocols or practices were as they were loading these ships that they were being encouraged to employ?
Well, in fact, no one had been trained for loading ammunition on these ships. The sailors had been trained at the Great Lakes Naval Training Station, where all the sailors were trained. They were trained to be radio operators. They were trained to be gunner's mates. They were trained to be everything, but no one was trained in ammunition handling, which was the work to which they would be assigned. And so it was this lack of training, number one, for the sailors and for the officers, by the way, that created the unsafe working conditions there, including the fact that one of the officers created a board that he posted in the dock office showing how much ammunition was loaded by each work division each day. In effect, they were encouraged to compete. They were required to compete against each other in loading ammunition, which, of course, is an insane idea. But the lack of experience by the officers and certainly the lack of training by the sailors themselves was the fundamental problem here. And the officers pushing the men to work ever faster. The rushing itself, I think, was a big factor that contributed to the explosion. And it was the officers who were pushing this by encouraging competition, which is, of course, makes no sense at all.
Robert, why in today's political climate is this event still relevant and important to uplift and talk about?
Well, I think it's important to talk about because, as you know, we're in a period now when we're dealing with the question of whether Black lives matter.
Mm-hmm.
And I say whether because I think this is still an issue in our society. And the young people who are raising this question are really carrying on a tradition here that goes way back even to the earlier periods of the Civil Rights Movement. And I think this incident that happened was an example at that time, that is the explosion, the work stoppage, and so on, was an example of the way in which Black lives did not matter to the U.S. military at that time. And this protest by the sailors, the work stoppage, and ultimately the trial itself, the intervention by Thurgood Marshall, really did raise the question of, do Black lives matter, even at that time, and even though the phrase was not used. So I think that when we think of Port Chicago, we have to think of it in the context of a long struggle that has occurred in this country and that is still going on, which has to do with the fact that do we value black lives in this country in the same way that we value white lives? And I think the answer that we're seeing is no, we do not. And that this is still a question that's very much on the agenda for the American people.
Right. Well, Robert, thank you so much for joining us this morning. We appreciate your voice and your work. This Sunday.
Thank you.
This Sunday, July 17th, 2016, from 3:30 to 8 o'clock p.m., the National Park Service and the Friends of Port Chicago National Memorial will commemorate the 72nd anniversary of the Port Chicago explosion in Concord, California, at the former Concord Naval Weapons Station. The station is closed to the public, so visitors have to be shuttled, and buses will pick up guests at the Pittsburgh Bay Point BART station starting at 3:30 p.m., running a continuous loop throughout the event. You can RSVP to this free event at portchicago72.eventbrite.com or by calling 925-228-8860 extension 6424, 925-228-8860 extension 6424. Next up, we will discuss the rise of white supremacist organizations and ideologies in Northern California and speak with David Nywart from the Southern Poverty Law Center and activist Cedric O'Bannon, who was stabbed at a recent counter-protest in Sacramento. That's next, after the news.
I'm Eileen Alfandary with KPFA News headlines. French President François Hollande is visiting Nice, the site of last night's rampage by a truck driver who mowed down scores of people after Bastille Day celebrations. The death toll stands at 84 and could increase. After visiting a hospital where victims are being treated, French President Hollande said about 50 people are hanging between life and death. Hollande extended the country's state of emergency for another 3 months.
France is tearful, afflicted, but France is strong and will always remain stronger than the fanatics who want to harm her.
There's been no claim of responsibility. Authorities have identified the truck driver as a 31-year-old French Tunisian man. Family members said his wife was divorcing him. The father of an unarmed 19-year-old man shot and killed by Fresno police has filed a claim. Darren Noble says the culture of lax discipline in the Fresno Police Department led officers to needlessly kill his son Dylan. Officers shot Dylan Noble, who is white, on June 25th during a traffic stop. They later learned he was unarmed. We'll have a report from Vic Bedoyan on the 8 a.m. news. Mourners gather today to pay their last respects to Alton Sterling, fatally shot by police officers in Baton Rouge last week outside a convenience store. Sterling leaves behind five children. Yesterday, Philando Castile was laid to rest. He was fatally shot by a police officer last week in suburban St. Paul. Secretary of State John Kerry did not directly discuss military cooperation between Russia and the U.S. in Syria when he met Russian President Vladimir Putin last night. That's according to the Kremlin. Kerry had been expected to seek closer Russian cooperation in the war against the Islamic State in Syria. Weather forecast for the San Francisco Bay Area. Patchy fog, partly cloudy skies this morning, then sunny and breezy. Highs in the 70s to lower 80s around the bay, lower to mid-90s well inland. In Fresno and the central San Joaquin Valley, sunny highs 98 to 104 degrees. I'm Eileen Alfandary. More news on 94.1 at 8 o'clock.
You are listening to Upfront. I am Kat Brooks, filling in for Brian Edwards Tickert. Northern California is home to large numbers of white supremacist organizations. What does this mean for the political climate, organizers, and the safety of resistance? In studio with me this morning, I have two organizers. I have Cedric O'Bannon, a local organizer. Hello, Cedric. And I've got B, an anti-racist, anti-fascist organizer. Good morning, B.
Good morning, Kat.
Thank you both for being with me this morning. First, I just want to talk about the climate. And B, you've been doing this work for a while, I understand. What has been the climate of these groups coming to Northern California? What's going on?
Well, I mean, to put it into context, it seems like in the United States in general, but in California in particular, there's a massive polarization that's happening in the political spectrum. This is sort of like in the wake of the Black Lives Matter, the ascension of that movement, gaining power, wide criticism against the police and racist police practices. On the other side of that spectrum, white supremacist groups are taking up a narrative of self-victimization. And
what does that mean? Explain what that means to our listeners.
Their narrative of self-victimization basically means that they're painting themselves as being the victims of sort of like a narrative about white people are being oppressed by other people of color because we're now claiming our dignity, and they're not being prioritized and privileged in the ways that they used to be. And the way that they're used to being treated, excuse me, and that they need to reassert their privileges, which means the denial of our dignities in the streets and in the political and social arenas. So that's basically their narrative of self-victimization. So that polarization is becoming much bigger and wider as time goes on. What happened on June 26th in Sacramento was an attempt for them to finally materialize their politic. Now, these white supremacist groups, most of their presence is mostly online. And it's a very insular communication that they have with these other groups. So June 26 was an attempt for them to materialize their politic in the street, which is why anti-racist and anti-fascist organizers took it so seriously to prevent them from actually having that presence in the street.
So let's just take a step back. So traditionally, these groups are talking to each other online, spewing out hate across social media, and then they called for an action on June 26th in Sacramento at the nation's capital, right?
That's correct.
And then it wasn't just one group. So talk about then the organizing that led up to the counter-protests that happened in Sacramento that day.
So, I mean, basically, so people know, the three white supremacist groups that were meeting were the Traditionalist Workers' Party, the Ku Klux Klan, and a group called the Golden State Skinheads. So all three of these groups, it's hard to say what their level of organization was together prior to June 26th. But June 26th was an attempt for them to consolidate all of their political capital together that existed, again, mostly online, and materialize it into the streets. Now, I listened to the leader of the Traditionalist Workers Party's podcast, and he basically claimed that if these white supremacist groups could meet in California, when, you know, a very liberal place in the United States, then they could meet anywhere in America. Mm. So their attempt was to break ground here first, in one of the harder places it is to exist as a white supremacist group, to prove to themselves and to prove to the people that are following their rhetoric that they could do it anywhere in the United States.
But don't they have ground in Northern California? I mean, that's like almost a scary place to drive. That seems to be, you know, that area, Sacramento, and in that area, and then through sort of the you know, Fresno,
the valley,
right? Yeah. That's sort of their stronghold as it is. Is that accurate?
That's pretty accurate in terms of the people that they're trying to recruit from. And again, this is mostly because it fits their narrative of self-victimization.
Mm-hmm.
White, poor, working class people are being preyed upon by these white supremacist organizations to get them into their groups because they lack the political consciousness to criticize the actual institutionalized disenfranchisement that they're actually experiencing.
Cedric, people, if you do engage in protest in Oakland or San Francisco in the Bay Area, you've likely seen Cedric with his live streamer and cameras out there. Why did you decide to go?
You know, for me, it was a natural extension of the police terror protests that I've been documenting for the last, 20-plus months. We've seen this phenomenon with the counter-protests against Trump. So it was, a natural extension for me to, try to be there in Sacramento and document what was happening. I'm against, these white nationalists and their terroristic attacks that we saw happen in Southern California. Mm-hmm. So I said, yeah, I should be there documenting.
We have just been joined on the phone by David Nywart. He is the Northwest correspondent for the Southern Poverty Law Center. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
David, can you paint a picture for us of these white extremist groups in America? Let's go beyond California for just a minute.
Sure. Well, in fact, it's important to understand that this is not just happening in California. It's happening everywhere. And a lot of it has to do with, there's no question that the Donald Trump campaign has absolutely revivified a lot of these previously moribund white supremacist organizations. However, it's also important to understand that this is a phenomenon that's been growing for a long time, and as you pointed out, these people are preying on people's economic insecurities, their frustrations, their anger, and they're really exploiting the failures of the democratic system to adequately provide for all of us. And it's what happens in an oligarchy. And honestly, in an oligarchy, they constantly, you'll find that they do this sort of thing where they're really kind of setting up the two. It's a wedge issue. It's a way of dividing working class people against themselves so that they can't ever unite to actually take on, the larger powers that be.
The
traditionalist youth movement, which is who we saw in Sacramento, and they will be in Cleveland, has been very active. They're calling themselves the alt-right. They've given themselves all kinds of trendy new names now. But really, it's just the same old ugly racism that, is not really an iota different than what Hitler promoted.
I was sort of struck by the fact that B talked about that there were skinheads there and there was the Klan there. Mm-hmm. Can you, just for our audience, so the difference between a skinhead and a Nazi or the Klan, and B, also feel free to jump in there.
Sure. Well, these are shades of difference. They all fundamentally believe kind of the same thing, but they'll have they have different flavors of racism, and that's essentially what we're talking about here. Neo-Nazis there's a lot of overlap, especially between neo-Nazis and skinheads and white nationalists, which is what the, traditionalist youth movement call themselves. The nationalists tend to emphasize, their so-called promotion of the white race, but as always, with all of these organizations, they inevitably always descend into, the demonization and degradation of other races. Neo-Nazis and skinheads, they just hate everybody, there's a huge amount of overlap among them, and what can you say? I mean, they're just some of the most awful people on the planet.
I mean, one thing that I notice in terms of, like you're saying, shades of racism, there's also, different types of functions. Like, the traditionalist youth network and the traditionalist worker party kind of serve the function more of, the intellectual part of white racism. So they're the ones that are sort of talking about, they're like the academics. They're talking about the economy. They're talking about, the social structure, the political structure. Whereas, skinheads are more the boneheads. They don't have much of an intellectual analysis, but they will be out there and fight.
They're the muscle.
They're the muscle, exactly. They're the street presence. So, for example, on June 26th, the Traditionalist Workers' Party are the people who called for the demonstration, and Matthew Heimbach, was the leader of that group, was supposed to be there. Weeks prior, started to back out and backpedal from being there, and basically the only people who showed up were the goons and the thugs.
And What about the Klan? We just saw actually a news report that the Klan was walking around San Francisco, of all places, putting flyers in people's homes, warning them, you know, that the Black Panthers and the Black Lives Matter folks are on the rise. Are they normally in this mix, or are they still relevant, David?
Yes, yeah, they've always been. You know, we saw the Klan up here in northern Idaho back in the 70s and 80s, very tightly associated with the Aryan Nations folks. And so they've been around. You know, people forget that the Ku Klux Klan was a national organization in the 1920s. They had chapters in every state in the country, and they actually controlled the legislatures of states such as Oregon and Indiana. They've been latent in the landscape for all this time, and you know, now they're starting to reemerge.
Cedric, as a Black man listening to this, what is your greatest concern?
I think my greatest concern is that we really expose the true narrative that's not getting out of the state-permitted violence. That, you know, the California Highway Patrol, to me, has just as much responsibility as the traditional Workers' Party in their ignorance and rhetoric.
Perfect. Let's go there. So on June 26th, The skinheads, these white nationalist groups, had called for this action. They got a permit. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
They got a permit to be there. The counter-protest decided to show up. What happens when the two groups meet?
Well, I mean, essentially what had happened was that, because they've had permits, the white nationalists have had permits to meet at the Capitol before.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had regularly been taking the steps of the Capitol. What was different about this time was that, again, they had pronounced that they were getting all of these other groups together, and this was going to be their way to, push forward and make their politic material. So they had originally been meeting at a parking garage and then being escorted by the police to the West Steps of the Capitol. This time, the counter-demonstrators had decided to meet at 9 a.m. The scheduled permit for the white nationalists was at 11 to start to set up. My hunch is that they had seen how many people were there to resist them and decided not to be in the parking garage. They had come from the opposite end of the West Steps. We had sent someone in the parking garage to see if there were any cars. There were no cars in there. So we basically decided that it was time to just move to the West Steps because we knew that that was the end goal of the place that they wanted to be. On the way to the West Steps, they were spotted with their banners, huge flags, shields.
Shields.
They came with shields. And when we had seen them, people were going over to confront them. And as soon as the two groups got close enough, they started stabbing people.
Where were the police?
The police at the time of the confrontation were nowhere to be found. They had actually showed up maybe 5 minutes or so after the first few stabbings had happened and knew that the people had gotten stabbed and continued to try and separate the two groups and basically made an exit route for the white supremacists to leave after they had stabbed people.
No attempts to arrest anybody?
Absolutely not.
No attempts to detain anybody?
No.
And they knew, because there was a permit, I just want to reiterate for our listeners, the police knew that these white nationalist groups were coming, and they clearly knew y'all were on the way because they monitor social media, right?
Absolutely.
But no police presence anywhere?
No police presence at the time of confrontation. There were hundreds of police in the area.
David, I want to throw that to you. Is this typical protocol for law enforcement when they know these actions are going to take place?
Well, I will say that what he's describing sounds like extremely questionable behavior on the part of the police. I've covered a lot of these kinds of rallies in the past, and it's unfortunate, but it's something that happens at all of them, that essentially the police wind up being pushed into the role of being bodyguards for these guys. Because typically what you have is just, you know, a group of 10 to 20 neo-Nazis or white supremacists and a huge crowd of several hundred counter-protesters. And so, yeah, the police wind up being sort of their bodyguards for them.
But it sounds like they were just bodyguards. They were absent.
The failure to intervene is inexcusable, and I hope that, you know, there's an investigation of it by the Attorney General's office. There certainly should be an investigation of it.
I mean, beyond the criticism of the actual police, we can also see that the judicial system is also protecting white supremacists. In Anaheim, there are 9 counter-protesters who are now being charged with assault and battery, who are all injured by the KKK.
So in Anaheim, that was last year, I believe, right? That was last year. The Klan said that they held a demonstration in Anaheim that also turned violent. And so the Klan's not being charged, but the counter-protesters are.
That's right.
No, and what can I say? We as an organization, I can't speak for our legal team, but I can tell you that as an organization, we view these kinds of things, behavior by the judicial system, by the system in general, as extremely, very much a source of concern. And I think that they should be exposed as much as possible. But certainly, it's inappropriate for, as happened in Anaheim, we are talking Orange County, for that sort of thing, to happen. And so, I can't speak for our legal team, because we do take on these kinds of cases, but I do know that that sort of thing causes a lot of concern.
So
it's wrong. There's unquestionably, it's just dead wrong.
So Cedric, you go out to film this action like you filmed so many actions before, and what happens to you?
Well, there certainly weren't any bodyguards around.
Not for you.
Yeah, I mean, there was hundreds and hundreds of police officers around, plus helicopters in the sky. This is a Sunday morning at about 11:45 on the South Side State Capitol lawn. There's children playing. One mother had brought her a child there because she homeschools her, to teach her about the Capitol. And they have to witness all this. Where is their bodyguards? We pay, you know, taxes for protection, you know, supposedly from terrorist organization like this white nationalist group. But it seems clear to me, historically and even now, that there's a direct relationship between these white nationalist organization and the law enforcement agencies that are supposed to be our bodyguards. These were the bodyguards that you see on a prison yard that just allow prisoners to shank each other until they die.
And you were stabbed.
Yeah, I was attacked with my camera. I was right trying to be at the front to get the confrontation of the two groups. And I was attacked. My camera rig broken in half. And when I went to go get my action camera off the ground, I was stabbed with the flagpole in the side. And if it wasn't for the anti-fascist counter-demonstrators, I wouldn't have had any bodyguards. Those were my bodyguards. Those are the people that came to defend me. And I thank the left for that, and I thank the left for their solidarity and staying together and having unity in actually defending us. So as a black man, I felt like, yeah, my only security was the left. The police were letting me get, they would have let me got stabbed to death there.
What about medical attention? So how many people were injured from the left, particularly, I'm asking?
There were 9 people injured in total.
And what was the racial makeup of those 9 people?
I'd say probably at least like 4 were African American. There were some other that I'm not really sure what their racial background.
But also people of color.
Also people of color. And then of the white people who were injured, most of them were trans.
Right, trans folks.
Trans or queer folks.
Right. So then what was the medical attention? What happened? There's people are bleeding, clearly. And what did law enforcement do?
So well, there's 2 parts to the medical attention. Part of it was part of the actual organizing effort. A lot of the organizing effort was very inclusive in the sense to not make people feel like fighting racism and fighting fascism meant that you had to be on the front line alone. So there was a lot of legal support that was going on, people answering phones, and there were also medics who were trained weeks prior to the demonstration because we were afraid that it was going to come to this type of confrontation. So the first responders were actually people from the anti-fascist, anti-racist side that dealt with people's injuries. So mainly just clotting the blood, holding the wounds, and then the ambulance came. Law enforcement just basically got the medics away from the people who were injured.
I don't understand either. But no, really, say that again. The law enforcement kept the medics from attending to the people who were injured?
The medics were the first responders and were doing their job and tending to the wounded. As soon as the police came up, they tried to separate the medics from the people who were wounded.
Wow.
Wow.
David, a response to that?
Yeah, all I can say is wow. You know, I mean, this is the first I've heard that. So
maybe something your legal team should look into.
Yeah, absolutely.
There has been some community investigation. So I want to continue to sort of unravel this thread in the last couple minutes that we have about collusion between the police and these white nationalist groups. I've seen pictures on Facebook of people that were stabbers, right? Information, their names, their faces. The community's really done this work. What arrests have been made?
Zero, to my knowledge, unless Cedric, you know of any.
No.
Go ahead.
They said the investigation is still going on right now.
Investigation is ongoing. Have they questioned you?
They came to interrogate me before. When I was in the hospital and, you know, I asked them to return my SIM card, they came back with the SIM card erased. And, you know, they asked me if I wanted to press charges. I said yes, and I've never heard from them since.
So I just want to go back to the SIM card issue very quickly. So when you went to the hospital, you had your camera and your SIM card.
Yes.
And in the process, we won't go into detail, but in the process, right, the SIM card gets taken by law enforcement.
Yes.
And you have it back, but...
Yeah, it was erased, you know, somehow crazy, they left a note that they had took it, you know, 2 days before they got a search warrant to take it. And so I was able to have them return it, but it, you know, it was erased, you know, trying to see if we could recover it now.
Just one last thought from each of our guests. We are living in incredibly politically charged times. We're clearly going to see more of this. David, from your perspective, what should people be doing to protect themselves?
Well,
can I say one thing real quick?
Yeah, I think it is important to stand up to white supremacists and people like that. I do think it's, you know, what can I say? Certainly the best demonstration, counter-protest I ever saw was one where they chose not to confront them violently, but instead showed up to make fun of them, showed up in clown suits, and it turned into a festive affair, and I think it changed the whole atmosphere.
B, what do you think?
Of the thing. And honestly, it infuriated the Nazis far more than a straight counter-protest did. A straight counter-protest actually is exactly what they want.
B, 20
they
seconds, what do you think?
I mean, in my opinion, I think that we're not necessarily trying to stop white nationalists from meeting up because we think their ideology is going to spread. Mainly their ideology is racist and is a form of terrorism and should be confronted by all and any means necessary.
Cedric, 30 seconds. You have the last word.
Stop state violence. You know, don't even give the terrorists a permit.
That does it for today's show. Up Front is a production of the KPFA News Department. Thank you to our guests for being here. We air weekday mornings at 7 a.m. and post information about our topics and our guests online at kpfa.org, where you can also dig through our archives, subscribe to the show as a podcast, and connect to us on social media. If you'd like to give us feedback on something you heard or suggest something for us to cover, send us an email at upfront@kpfa.org. A big thanks to everyone who makes the show happen. Eileen Alfandari is our executive producer and news editor. Linda Cordy is our producer. Kirsten Thomas is at the controls. Our production interns are Claire Breen and Georgiana Du. I'm Kat Brooks, sitting in for Brian Edwards-Tiekert. Stay tuned for Rising Up with Sonali Kohatkar.
Join us for the screening of One Grigio. This award-winning short film uses animation and folkloric dance about a boy who discovers the secret to free the people of Maizcalpa, enslaved by an evil giant. Director Martha LeClaire will be on hand for a brief Q&A. All ages are welcome at this celebration of the 37th anniversary of the Nicaraguan Revolution. There will be traditional food and salsa dance.